Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday. We have a technical problem, so our first guest is not with us yet, if at all. But I did want to find out from our listeners how they're keeping up with political, what's going on in politics via social media. Are there any special apps you're using? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to be talking about the iPhone 5 coming up. You can tell us what you think about that. We'll do a little unscientific, informal poll. Do you love it? Do you hate it? Did you order it? Do you have to have it? Is it worth it? Or are you going to wait for the next iPhone? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Okay, it looks like we have our guest now. But I want to just put out the numbers again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kent German, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You were on last week telling us what you predicted or what the rumor mill had it as far as the iPhone 5 goes. iPhone 5 pre-orders topped $2 million in the first 24 hours, shattering the previous record. So is it a matter of pent-up demand, or does it reflect real success in the design department? What do you think, Kent?
A couple things. You know, this is an iPhone. It's a very popular device. It's made by Apple. And anytime one goes on sale, you know, people are going to be interested. You also have to remember that this is a much bigger upgrade than the one we saw last year, which is the iPhone 4S. It has a few things that people are waiting for a long time, like LTE, which is the 4G high-speed data service, the little bit of a different design with the taller screen. And so these are things we've been waiting for a long time, mm-hmm. and we finally get them. So I think people are just excited.
Little changes that make it overall a much better phone. The weight is a big change for a lot of people.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Scott Stein, who was in our seat at Scott Stein, who was actually at the Apple event, got to hold it that day, and he said it was extremely light and much lighter than the 4S, and you really noticed a difference. But still, you know, pretty solid feeling. Still feels like it's it is going to last a long time. It still has a nice feeling in the hand.
I was going to say, you know, I have a 4S, and it's like, you know, I don't really need it much lighter because I'll forget it's in my hand. I don't want to have it snap in half. And it did come, it doesn't have the glass back anymore either, right?
No, it doesn't. It has a little glass at the top and mm-hmm. the bottom of the back, but there's mainly a big metal band that's across the back.
And then someone referred to the feeling, the hand in the hand, that it's hard to describe. Can you describe it? What's the difference?
I actually haven't held it yet, so I can't.
Oh, okay.
But I know that, you know, I did talk to Scott about it, and he did just say that you'll just be shocked, actually, the difference. And I think that's fine. You know, I think that the bigger a phone gets, there's always the danger that it just becomes too bulky and heavy. And since this phone is bigger, Apple's just trying to say, well, we're not going to make it too heavy. It's not going to, you know, become too much of a weight in your pocket or a bag or anything like that. So I think that's the sort of the middle ground they're walking here.
And then I think it was you that wrote about the new dynamic light mode that lets you launch photo apps more quickly. What's the point of that? How does that work?
Well, there are a couple of things. I mean, there's a couple things going on there. You can, with the launching apps quickly, that's something that people are always, you know, always interested in. That comes partially from a faster processor in the phone, mm-hmm. where you can get things up quicker. You don't have to wait a long time, especially when you're taking a photo, because especially, you know, things can happen really quickly and you want to capture it right away. And then in the display, there are also a few things. There's, the resolution is about the same, but it is bigger, so some of the things that you are waiting for, like more space and more space for apps, more space for watching videos and things like that, those are also built in.
My guest is Kent German, Senior Managing Editor for CNET. If you want to weigh in on what your your observations are about the new iPhone 5, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Did you or did you not order one? If you were looking to order one and decided against it, which would put you in the minority, I think, give us a call and tell us why. If you did order one, give us a call and tell us what was the tipping point for you. Kent, still, I mean, I mentioned 2 million in 24 hours. That not only shattered the previous record, it doubled the previous record.
Yeah, it did.
I mean, and go ahead.
I think we've seen it. We really expected this to be a winner because this is the phone that I think a lot of people were waiting for last year. We heard last year was going to be the iPhone 5. We heard about a different design. We heard about LTE. All these things that we're getting now didn't get last year. So, you know, a lot of people bought it last year, as they would. But a lot of people upgraded with the iPhone 4, which would be 2 years ago. So you have to consider that all of those people that got on the 4 are probably off their contract now. So they're ready to upgrade, and they can get a new phone by paying that subsidy. So there was a lot of pent-up demand, especially for those people.
And an additional ability to take photos while shooting video, how does that work, that you could just take the each cell from the video and use that?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure how this works yet, but as I imagine it, I think that, you know, you are shooting video and maybe you do want to capture a still. So, you know, maybe somebody's dancing or something and you want to see this one spot. While the video's filming, you may be able to press some sort of the button and then it captures that one moment in the video. Not really sure, but that's certainly one of these features that, you know, if you asked me a week ago, I'd say I need that in my iPhone. I need something to take a photo while video. But it's one of those nice to have features, and Apple's good about adding those things as they go along. When we get a new operating system, when we get a new phone, they say, "Oh, here's something you haven't thought of," and, you know, have at it. So we'll have to see how it works exactly, but I think that's pretty much it.
I can tell you why it will be helpful, because of the times that I've started to think I'm taking a picture when I've been taking a video and going, "Oh, crap," and then it's over with. If I could cut out some cells from that, I might achieve that, what I was shooting for in the first place. We have an email from Sarah. She says, "I am in a 2-year contract, so I won't be getting an iPhone 5 anytime soon. I will probably end up with an iPhone 5S or iPhone 6, but I don't like the new charger. I like that my phone, iPad, and iPod can all use the same charger." That's a big gripe out there. Not only that, but some people are criticizing Apple for not just throwing it into the deal. They're charging $30 and $40 for these things.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate drawback with this phone, or at least, you know, the changing the connector. A lot of other manufacturers have done that, and frankly, the connector that we've had for a long time, it was kind of clunky, it would wear out, it would get stuck, it was kind of big. Mm-hmm. But so we weren't surprised that Apple moved to something new, but it does mean that all of those accessories out there, from alarm clocks, you know, you see these in hotels, you check in, there's iPod docks, you see them in first-class seats on an airplane, in cars, so many places that have built in this huge accessory business. And all of that stuff is going to be useless with this new phone. You're going to have to get an adapter or a cable, and the adapter, which is probably the most popular thing, is $30. You don't get one in the box. You can buy it at the store, of course. You know, Apple makes a lot of money off these things. So it is unfortunate that all of your current stuff is going to be, accessories are going to be rendered obsolete, and you're going to have to pay to even use them.
Tim, in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Just had a quick question about, I think my answer off the air, but I had a question about who you think that the biggest competitor is going to be to the iPhone 5, and also with the releasing of the Jelly Bean, if that's going to be a huge factor or not.
Okay, Tim, thank you.
Thank you.
Kent German?
Well, a couple of the most popular phones that we think that are probably going to be competitors to the iPhone 5 would be the existing Samsung Galaxy S3, which has been out for a few months now, and it's a pretty nice phone. It's out with a lot of carriers. We're going to see Lumia, or a couple weeks ago in New York, Nokia introduced the Nokia Lumia 920, which is a Windows phone device. That seems like it's going to be pretty nice. It's not out yet. We don't know when it's going to come out, but the caller's right, the Jelly Bean, once that arrives, that's another Android operating system update. That's the newest one. That's very nice. It's the best one we've seen. Really transforms Android phones, makes them run really well, a lot of new features. So when that arrives on a lot of phones, it's going to be a competing, or going to make them competing devices, absolutely.
Andy and Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Hi, Ann and Ken. I I guess we kind of forget that these are phones, and so I'm wondering if there's an improvement in the audio quality of the new iPhone, and how long do we have to wait before, you know, we get a really decent audio quality from a cell phone?
Well, that's a good question, you know, because these are phones, and we forget that at the end of the day in a lot of cases. And you know, for much of its history, the iPhone's call quality, you know, it hasn't been spectacular. The first few were, and then with the iPhone 4, you know, we had a problem with the antenna for a while, which Apple fixed by adding a case to it. But, you know, with this phone, we do see additional microphones. So we're hopefully so that's a total of 3 microphones to get your voice. So hopefully that builds up the quality on your end so the person listening to you can hear better. And Apple has continued to redesign the antenna. And with the new phone, we get a little bit of changes there. I'm not sure exactly what they are quite yet, but Your call quality, is also going to – it's just going to vary by carrier. And this is out with 3 carriers, Sprint, Verizon, AT&T. It's going to be out with some smaller carriers like Cricket and can't remember the other ones right now. But hopefully we will see better. And I think it's getting better as the device has gone on. But with the new microphone and redesigned antenna, hopefully we'll see even more improvements.
You know, I've got it hooked up to YouTube, Bluetooth in my car, and that's the best sound quality I've ever had on a cell phone. Andy, thanks for your call.
All right, thanks, Ian.
Take care.
Bye.
Dave in Grandview, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Hi. I'm calling because I am not going to upgrade to this new phone. I've got a 4S, but I will put the new operating system on tomorrow when it's released. I'm wondering about the degradation in the speed associated with a new operating system running on older hardware. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Okay, thanks, Dave. Good question. Ken German?
That's always a concern. And I think with the 4S, you're going to be okay. It really, when you add these new operating systems to even older iPhones, so maybe the 3GS or maybe even the 4, it's hard to say. That's always been a concern. But that's usually 2 generations ago. So if you have the 4S, you put this new operating system on, I think you'll be fine.
And Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I have a question about the transmission. I've heard something about 100 gigabyte BPS services that are is now being able through fiber optics and stuff. And I'm wondering, will that phone be able to interface with it? Is it too early, too late? Will they be on different systems and it won't matter?
Kent?
Not quite sure what you're referring to, actually.
Well, maximum speed right now is about 20 gigabytes per second. And now we've suddenly got basically 5 times that at 100 gigabytes per second. And I don't think it's throughout the whole network yet, but will that phone be able to interface it, or won't they even have anything to do with each other?
Oh, you mean through the LTE service?
Yeah. Right now, it's through educational networks, but I'm sure that possibility is going to be worldwide and network wide soon.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if it will be able to handle exactly what you're talking about. But one of the benefits of LTE, and you know, the problem with LTE though is, of course, it's not available everywhere. And AT&T and Verizon have really pretty robust networks. Sprint's only about 19 cities right now, and it's growing. But if you're a Sprint customer, you're going to have to wait maybe a while if you don't live in one of the top urban areas. But the iPhone 5 will be able to develop or will be able to handle those faster data speeds, so faster downloads, faster app downloads, faster music, faster streaming, all of that kind of stuff that you're expecting.
Well, Kent German, thanks for helping us out today. We really appreciate it.
Sure, thank you.
Kent German, he's Senior Managing Editor for CNET. Coming up, we're going to talk about those political apps, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
With Election Day almost upon us, a question. Are you who you say you are? And if so, how much should you pay to prove it?
What's $60? What's $30? For people who are on minimum wage, which is a lot of people, that's a lot of money.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The dollars and cents of voter ID laws next time on Marketplace. It's from APM. That's American Public Media.
Marketplace tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. Showers off and on throughout the day today, maybe a thunderstorm as well, a high of 67. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 41 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from The Women's Book, hosting their fourth annual release event September 27th at the Hilton at Easton. This year's theme is Resilience, Stories of Innovation and Inspiration, featuring a panel discussion led by the CEO of Working Mother magazine, Carol Evans, and Ernst & Young CEO, Jim Turley. Details at thewomensbook.com. And All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
With the presidential election right around the corner, the candidates are fighting hard to win the social media campaign. In the meantime, social network websites are competing to deliver political apps to keep track of the latest election coverage. Joining us now is Alex Fitzpatrick. He's a reporter at the social media blog site Mashable's New York headquarters, where he covers the intersection of politics, international affairs, social media, and technology. Welcome back to the show, Alex.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back.
So what are some of the features that make an outstanding political app, in your opinion, besides tracking the latest poll data?
Sure. I mean, besides tracking the latest poll data, the things that I really like to see are apps that use what's called Facebook's Open Graph in really unique ways. And Open Graph is the technology behind Facebook that connects you to all of your friends in interesting ways. When you're looking at your Facebook feed, for instance, it shows you, you know, what your friends are reading and what your friends are talking about. That's all Open Graph. And that power, that technology, can create really interesting political apps that are just sort of right now starting to be developed and get fleshed out.
Is this the sort that includes maybe like a Foursquare app for, you know, fellow Democrats or fellow Republicans or fellow Ron Paul fans?
I haven't seen anything along the lines of a Foursquare app that matches people based on their political persuasion. I know Foursquare itself is developing an app that will, not an app, but it's going to be built into Foursquare, where on election day, if you check into your polling place, you get the digital version of the famous I voted sticker on your Foursquare profile.
Some critics think campaigns are missing the boat if they don't employ mobile apps to conduct polls. So we're not talking about tracking the latest poll data, but creating polls via the app is. So asking questions like, well, I guess someone asked rhetorically in an article I read, how would you feel as a voter if your candidate was capable of asking your opinion and didn't?
Right. I haven't seen, actually, any campaigns using mobile tech as a polling mechanism. What I have seen in the mobile field that I'm excited about as far as innovation goes is the Obama campaign's new app has a field organizing feature built into the app. And what that lets Obama volunteers and staff do on the ground is see on their phone a map of their area where likely Democratic voters live, so they know which doors to go knock on and say, and give them a script of things that they should say to that person. And then when they're done, when the volunteer or staff member is done interacting with that likely voter, they can enter in information about that interaction into what's called NGPVAN, which is the Democrat and Progressive voter file software. And then that interaction is recorded forever so that the campaigns know, okay, we talked to this person, he said this or she said this, and then they know where to go from there.
Now, there has been some conflict or criticism over getting that contact information through the apps. It's going too far, some people think.
Yeah, there are certainly some privacy concerns that have been brought up. Anybody can download the app and see, get the map of where these likely Democratic voters live. And when you ask the Obama campaign about that, which I have, mm-hmm. they'll say, hey, this information is all coming right from the state elections board offices. It's all public information. People can get it if they want it from there. But the privacy people will come back and say, yeah, but you guys are putting it in the hands of everybody in a really easy to find way. So there are some privacy concerns there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Fitzpatrick. He's a reporter for Mashable. We're talking about political-related apps, campaign-related apps. If you have a particular favorite, something that you've just discovered and want to share it with us, give us a call, 614-292 8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet us at WOSU All Sides. So someone else was talking about the, well, first of all, let's go back to the idea of interactive apps. We were talking about polling or conducting polls on apps, but are there other ways to make an app interactive that makes it useful or helpful to a campaign and fun for the user?
Yeah, both of the Obama campaign and the Romney campaign apps have what's called event pages. So it's not completely interactive, but what those let you do is it uses the phone's geolocation data, where you are in the world, to tell you, okay, here are upcoming Obama or Romney events near you. So you can go to an office and volunteer for the campaign, things like that. So it's a way to get app users more involved in the campaign beyond just retweeting things on Twitter or liking things on Facebook.
I've noticed with Facebook, a lot of people say they don't want Facebook to be a political, soapbox. They don't like that happening on their Facebook pages, and they're deleting or not deleting, but hiding political references on their Facebook page. How's Facebook dealing with that? Because this could be a big deal for Facebook. Are they coping with that in any particular way?
Well, Facebook wants to encourage users posting whatever they want to an extent, of course. They're not going to go off and moderate things because some people don't want to see political discussion. That's up to the individual user as far as Facebook is concerned, and I agree with that. Facebook's actually encouraging political discourse on the platform. For instance, they've partnered with CNN to launch this co-branded app called I'm Voting, and it actually gives Facebook users more of an opportunity to talk about the candidates they like or the issues that matter to them. So they're encouraging the political discourse on Facebook, and that goes along with their business model. The more data they can get about their users and who they are as people and what policies they like, the better they can advertise to those people, and the more valuable those users become to Facebook advertisers. So it is, in a way, part of the business model.
You know, on the other hand, Twitter is impossible not to have political reference. Even if you go to the Uggs, hashtag Ugg, there's going to be political references at this point. Okay, so what about donate buttons in political apps? Are those common or not?
Yes, they are. It makes a lot of sense, in my opinion, for political apps to have donate buttons because the idea is, for instance, if you're on Mitt Romney's YouTube page and you were watching a web ad about Mitt Romney, that is a moment when, if you're a Mitt Romney supporter, you're fired up at that moment. You are gung-ho for the Romney campaign because you just watched this really great ad. So it makes all the sense in the world to have a little button right there on the YouTube page that says donate because that's when you're most likely to get hit. And it's much more effective than 10 years ago when, donations weren't, you couldn't tie donations to that high emotion, high impact moment as well as you can now. That's really, online donations are a really revolutionary thing in 2012, that the way they've been rolled out.
My guest is Alex Fitzpatrick, reporter for Mashable. We're talking about political apps. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Got a question, 614-292-8513. We take comments, too, and you can email those at allsides@wosu.org. Now, tell us what push notifications are and how they play into the political app.
Sure. A push notification, most apps require you to opt into those, so you have to say, hey, I want push notifications. And what they are is if something is happening in the world, you can get an alert on your phone, no matter what app you're using, or even if the phone is not in your hand at the moment, it'll give you a ring or a vibrate to get your attention. And a lot of, say, news apps use that. If there's breaking news, you get a push notification, hey, this just happened in country X. But what political apps do, if you turn on push notifications, they'll say, hey, Obama's about to give a speech, tune in live, or Romney's at this event, tune in live. So it's a way for supporters to get notified that, hey, this event in the campaign is happening. You should probably tune in. Here's a link to go do that. So it gives people a heads up, and they can go to YouTube or wherever the stream is and watch.
The networks have their own slew of presidential campaign ads. You mentioned some of them. You wrote about this last month. Let's go through those. NBC's Politics. You said there were nice maps.
Yeah, NBC's Politics app has a really good map of the country with polling data and, you know, which states are leaning which way, that kind of thing, and also has historical maps, which are really cool if you're a political geek as much as I am. You can go back in different presidential elections for hundreds of years and see, you know, how things unfolded in different elections, which is kind of interesting.
And then there's talking points, memos, poll tracker.
Poll Tracker is probably my favorite app that's been produced for the election by a media organization so far. It's one of the top two, in my opinion. It's really great. It combines all different sorts of polls, Gallup, Rasmussen, et cetera, and gives you this really easy to read, easy to flip through on your phone or tablet sort of a collection of these different polling numbers. So you have an idea. And it's not just for the presidential election, although for the presidential election you have states as well. But if you go down deeper, you can get into state elections and local stuff, and, you know, you can see the trends over time. So it's a really great way to keep your head in the game as far as where different candidates are in the polls at any given moment.
And you can compare them from state to state?
Yeah, you can compare the Romney and Obama poll numbers from state to state. So you can look at battleground states and, you know, your state and see how each candidate's doing.
Okay, then the Washington Post WP Politics. Different maps, any benefits?
Different maps, similar to what NBC's got going on, but Washington Post's focus is very much on presenting their election coverage in a very easy-to-read, tablet-friendly way. It's very tablet-focused, and you see it, you open it, and it's immediately intuitive to a tablet user. Okay, this is how I click on this article, and this is how I change things, and it's graphically very beautiful on a tablet. So that's what they were going for there.
And then Fox News has an iPad-only map, too. You Decide 2012. Again, tablet-focused. Are you seeing a lot of that?
Yeah, a lot of tablet apps. Tablets are really the name of the game this year for media outlets doing election-themed apps. The cool thing about the Fox News app is that you can come up with your own predictions for the election,
which
a lot of political geeks like to do. It's like fantasy football for political geeks. But what's awesome is Joe Trippi and Karl Rove are both involved with the app, and they're coming up with their own predictions, tweeting them out, and you can tweet your predictions to Rove and Trippi as well.
And compare notes.
And compare notes, exactly. So it's a fun little thing they're doing.
How does it actually work? Would you fill out a questionnaire? I mean, how does it actually work?
No, it's very intuitive, actually. You just open the map and you say, okay, I think this state's going to go for Obama, this state's going to go for Romney, et cetera. You determine, you know, how many electoral votes they'll get in each state, and then you see which way the state leans or state goes, and then it unfolds from there. You've got your prediction with your 270 electoral votes, and that's your prediction.
And are Rove and Trippi interacting with actually any of the app users, or they're
Yeah, I've seen them interact on Twitter with some people. They don't do it terribly often, but every once in a while they'll say, okay, you know, here's why I agree with you, or here's why I disagree with you, et cetera.
We have a Facebook question or comment from James. He says, Congress by the Sunlight Foundation is a great resource for keeping up with representatives and legislation year-round. It's an Android app.
Yes, Sunlight Foundation does some really great work on the development side as far as apps go. They've also recently introduced one of my favorite apps. There's actually two different iterations of this app. One's from Sunlight. One is called Super PAC App. And what they do is almost like Shazam, which is this program that you hold your phone up to a speaker at a bar or a restaurant, and it tells you the name and the artist of the song that's playing.
Mm-hmm.
It does similar. It uses the same technology. You hold it up to your TV while a political ad is playing, and it'll tell you who's behind the ad. It'll fact check it. It'll tell you how much money it cost if it knows all this great data about this ad that's playing. So suddenly you have this ad that's being presented to you, maybe it's from some strange outside group, some obscure super PAC, and now you know, okay, here's what these people are, here's what they're about.
That's kind of amazing almost.
Yeah, it's very cool, and it's a very much a crowdsourced application in that when their users see a new app come up, they, you know, ping, they tell the app developers, hey, I just saw this new ad in Iowa, but I don't know anything about it. And so the developers go in and say, okay, we found this video on YouTube. Now we know, you know, who these people are. Let's look into them. Let's add it to the program's database. And then next time somebody scans that ad, they get all that data.
So do you need near-field communication, NFC, or anything like that to do that?
No, it doesn't use NFC. It just uses audio recognition.
Huh.
So the audio from the YouTube ad or the TV ad gets picked up by your phone's microphone and then scanned through there.
All right. So then finally, the political playbook. You said it's been dubbed the ultimate insider's guide for political outsiders.
Yeah, Mike Allen's political playbook is pretty much everybody in politics reads that first thing in the morning. And it's a great rundown of the stories people need to know in politics, what's happening, what's shaking that morning. And it's presented in a way that's not too insidery, not too inside baseball. And their app is it's simple. It's not too complicated. It just presents basically the article that you would see on Politico.com in a mobile-friendly, tablet-friendly format. It can download automatically for you in the morning, so you've got it ready to go for the car, for the subway, for the bus, the train, what have you.
It seems like every election, particularly the big election cycle, something new comes out. Anything that has really astounded you this time, or is it just everything?
I mean, there's a lot. There's certainly a lot going on. I think the online donations and the way that they can peg online mm-hmm. donations to major events that happen right away is probably the story to tell as far as digital's impact on this election.
Because it lets the politician know or the candidates know what clicks and what doesn't.
Exactly. Exactly. It's instant analysis, instant analysis. Yeah.
And bringing home the bacon. Well, Alex Fitzpatrick, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Alex Fitzpatrick is a reporter for Mashable. Coming up, we're going to talk with Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Gaith Abdul-Ahad talks about traveling with Syrian rebel fighters for his new PBS Frontline documentary. He says the rebels don't have enough helmets, flak jackets, or experience.
In Syria, you meet someone in the morning and they die in the end of the day. As one of the officers was saying, the only thing we have plenty of is men.
Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News, and as a basic member of our station, your basic membership starts at just $60 and comes with great benefits, like a subscription to Newsweek magazine and a grocery tote. Visit WOSU.org, and thanks for your support of 89.7 NPR News. 66 degrees with showers off and on today, a high of 67. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 41 degrees. The rain will taper off, so some sunshine on Wednesday, but still chilly, a high of 66. Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, offering perspective in a time of economic uncertainty to help grow and maintain wealth. More information available online at themontgomerysolution.com. And support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back. Apple rolled out a few other items last week. Joining us to talk about that and more is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome as always, Russell.
Thanks for having me back.
First of all, it wouldn't be Tech Tuesday without getting your take on the new iPhone 5. So tell us, what do you think about it?
Well, I think Apple did a really good job of making sure that they improved every individual aspect of the iPhone without stepping too far out of their comfort zone. You know, the phone is very much what people would expect, you know, coming from an iPhone 3GS or an iPhone 4 for the next version of the iPhone without, you know, kind of breaking the mold.
And who competes with that?
I think right now Samsung is still the biggest competitor, especially with the Samsung Galaxy S3. Those two devices really, I think, are the two best devices on the market right now.
Anything particularly you really liked about? Have you? No one's really actually held the iPhone 5 in their hands, right?
The people who were in attendance at the press event got to spend time with it last week. I was not there, but I have done lots and lots and lots of research on it.
So what do you make of this special feel that it has in your hand?
I think that they're using, you know, special coated metals, which is something that we've seen a couple of other smartphone manufacturers do before. HTC uses something called a micro-oxidation to create a kind of a soft touch coating on the back of their metallic devices.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's good because it provides just enough surface grip that, you know, the phone's not going to slide out of your hand, which personally was an issue that I had with the glass iPhone. It just didn't, you know, it didn't feel particularly good in my hand. And if my hands were wet or if mm-hmm. I, you know, had my hands in gloves or anything like that, there was always a concern that it would fall out of my hand. I don't think you're going to get that as much with this version of the iPhone.
Okay. So let's look at the Apple Lightning adapters. Are those the adapters that are going for $30 and...
Well, there's two of them. There's okay. one that's going for $30 that's a direct connector. It's a single piece of plastic that connects the original 30-pin connector to the Lightning adapter. And then there's actually a $40 version where there's a couple of inches of cable in between the 30-pin connector that we're used to from Apple devices and this new Lightning adapter, which frankly I think are just crazy prices to charge for these adapters.
Well, it'll just, I mean, people have to have them if they're going to get the 5, but it just kind of ticks them off.
I think that it's really it's disheartening to see Apple take this route, considering, you know, this is not the first product they've had recently that have had the need for adapters. The new MacBook laptops have a new magnetic adapter that it's a wider adapter, and for people who already owned previous adapters for the laptops, they had converters that would allow you to do that, and they were only $10. To put that into a different perspective, the USB cable, you can get a separate USB cable from Apple that goes from USB on your computer to the new Lightning adapter, and that's only $20. And it's a significantly longer cable than what you would get with the adapter, the $40 adapter that Apple's providing. So it's something that people are going to have to get, especially if they have, you know, car mounts that have, you know, the 30-pin connector, or if they have a dock in their home. But I think it's really sad to see Apple, take advantage of this situation.
They've unveiled a range of improvements to both the iPod Touch and also the Nano. What's the deal with those?
So I was actually a little sad about the updates to the iPod Nano because the previous design, it was this little tiny square that, you know, had a touchscreen. You could slide back and forth and do things. And one of the coolest things that came from that release was a lot of different companies made these watch band like accessories mm-hmm. for the iPod Nano, so that you could wear it on your wrist. And I know several people who still use it as, you know, use it as their watch, use it as their music player when they're jogging or mm-hmm. when they're on an exercise machine. And you're not going to get that so much with the new Nano. The new Nano is longer. It's got a little bit bigger screen, and it's really kind of set up to feel more like a much smaller iPod instead of its own kind of device category.
Well, Nano's a Nano because it's small, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's good, you know, brand sense to make them all, you know, kind of fall in line and look as similar as possible. But the Nano devices have always kind of stood out in their own unique way. And I really, really liked the watch band design of the last version. But they made a lot of improvements with the Nano design. The screens are much higher quality. You can get versions with more storage now. They're Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, which mm-hmm. is a big deal for yeah. anyone who's jogging. The sports Bluetooth headsets are really, really nice, and you can't really use those with the previous versions. So, they're keeping all these devices at the same price, and they're adding a lot of technology to it, which is really exciting.
And pretty unusual, actually.
It's really standard for Apple. It's not something that we okay. see with a lot of other companies, but Apple has a pretty set price range, and they don't deviate from that too much.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We've been talking about the Apple rollouts. If you have a question about that or just about anything else, you're welcome to give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or tweet us at WOSU All Sides, or you can go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So, all right, so the iPod Touch?
The iPod Touch has always been, you know, kind of the iPod or the iPhone look, just with without the ability to make phone calls. And mm-hmm. they have two different versions now where it has the 4-inch screen to match the new version of the iPhone, as well as the original size iPod Touch, which is a little less expensive. And both of these versions now, you know, they have a significant hardware increase. They hold the same, you know, volume of storage as, you know, the iPhone versions. And they're really designed to be kind of a personal accessory. You know, the people who, you know, don't really want a smartphone, or people who want an iPod that does just a little bit more, these are still, you know, really great accessories for that.
Let's turn our sights to, we can gladly take more questions from anybody on any of those topics. Okay, and then the price is the same for the iPod Touch as well?
Yes.
Okay. Let's turn to the Wii U gamepad, because that looks really interesting.
It's interesting because it almost feels like Nintendo is going backwards. We've seen a lot recently with Sony and the PlayStation 3 and Microsoft with the Xbox. A lot of these companies are trying to make their controllers smaller and lighter and thinner. And you know, you take a look at the existing PlayStation 3 controller, which it feels like there's nothing there when you hold it compared to previous versions. The gamepad is a new design for the next console that Nintendo is going to be releasing, and it weighs more than a pound, and it has a almost 6.5-inch screen.
It looks big
in the middle of it, just this big kind of hulking thing. When you hold it, it feels really counterintuitive until you start using it.
So they wanted to show why the second screen would be useful, and how do you use a second screen?
Well, each one of the game designers have worked with Nintendo to incorporate that system into the games that they're going to be releasing when the Wii U comes out. And each one, you know, kind of took things from a different perspective. There's a lot of things that you can do with that second screen, and Nintendo's demonstrated that over the last couple of years with the Nintendo DS, mm-hmm. the portable console. And really, they're taking a lot of those same concepts and applying them to your television screen and this Wii U screen. You know, you can have something basic, like, you know, kind of extra menus and stuff if you want to go through. There can be interactive portions where, you know, there's things that you have to specifically do on the screen and have it interact with the television. And the real kind of big feature, I think, that sets the Wii U gamepad apart from a lot of the other consoles is that if you are playing a couple of different kinds of games, you don't actually even have to have the television on. You could be watching something in the room, and your child could be sitting in the living room playing their game, and it would be playing from the console, but it would all be wirelessly connected and not go through the television at all.
But it needs to be near the television.
You have to be within a certain range of the television. Okay. The connection, it's a wireless connection between the remote control and the console itself. It's not a you know, it's not a standalone system, but there's a lot, you know, I mean, you're talking basically about the size of a living room. If you go too much further than a living room, you're probably not going to have the best experience. But it also allows you to take advantage of the other services that are available with the Wii U, which include the ability to stream content from Netflix and Hulu and a couple other services. And if you have a TiVo connected to it, then you can access that content as well. So it really kind of takes this controller and gives it a lot more power than we've seen from game consoles in the past.
And you said you think the most common use of the gamepad screen will be when it comes to playing any action game is going to be the quick glance. The information displayed on the second screen is something that would otherwise be hidden by a menu.
A lot of times you find that in games where you've got, you know, either a radar that hides up in the corner of the screen, or the ability to switch tools when you're trying to complete puzzles or you know, any kind of thing like that. If you're playing a shooting game, then the ability to switch weapons or you know, reload or something like that. All of these things can be controlled from the screen, and all you need to do that is just glance down quickly and you know, tap whatever it is you need, and you can continue playing.
And there's a stylus involved with this gamepad.
The stylus isn't a requirement from the experience that I've had. I've played a lot of the different games where it gives you a little bit more accuracy in certain situations, but you can use your finger just as well. I found that to be kind of challenging, using the stylus, because when you're, with two hands, you're holding this 1-pound tablet and the weight's distributed pretty well and it's not so much a problem. With one hand and the stylus, if you're playing, a really active game, that whole experience, kind of weighs down on that left hand or that right hand after, 20, 30 minutes of playing the game.
Once again, my guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger at geek.com. If you have a question for Russell about any of the topics on the show today or just about anything, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We welcome any and all questions. We've only had one person stump Russell in the last 9 months. You wrote, I think this is you, that Nintendo has worked pretty hard to make the launch window titles on the Wii U feel like you are playing a whole new kind of game, but in your opinion, it wasn't accomplished across the board. What were you talking about there?
So there are some experiences where, it definitely doesn't feel like you need the gamepad in order to play the game. A lot of times Nintendo released alongside of the gamepad. You can still use the traditional, I say traditional, but the last generation, nunchuck and Wiimote controller that we saw with the last console. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a pro controller that was released as well that feels a lot like, kind of the Xbox 360 controller for doing things like, first-person shooter games or really kind of any action game where you're pressing a lot of buttons. The button layout for the Wii U gamepad, the pad and the extra buttons are directly beneath everything, and the way you hold the controller, it really makes it hard to make that switch quickly and still feel like you're playing the game and not just kind of moving your thumb around looking for the next thing to do.
And so you said owning one of these should bring a number of unique gameplay experiences, but only if developers take up the challenge and produce games tailored to the platform. How does that work? I mean, how does a game developer know when this is going to be worth it to them?
Well, Nintendo has always been a really successful platform. So I think that there's, major titles from all the different, manufacturers. And Nintendo has their own catalog of IP to make sure that they can demonstrate how successful games are with a new Zelda game or a new Mario Brothers game. So it really, after the launch window, these launch titles that Nintendo has partnered out with, it will show consoles were sold and how many of these games were sold, and that will indicate to the other game developers how much time they should spend.
We have a couple of emails, one from Steve. He says, my kid, 12 years old, is obsessing about the iPhone 5. He just likes to get into the technology hype, but I am not getting him an iPhone. He is too young and not responsible enough. If I get him an iPod Touch, which is cheaper, will that satisfy him? With an iPod Touch, he would just use Wi-Fi, right? No phone plan.
Correct. It just connects to the Wi-Fi. There's no phone plan. There are a couple of tools that if he's clever and if he does the right research online that allows him to make Wi-Fi phone calls over the iPod. But it requires a pretty fair bit of research in order to do it effectively.
Okay. And so we're talking about, of course, the new iPod Touch. And it, of course, is cheaper. What's that running at now?
They have versions that start at $199.
Okay. All right, Steve, hope that helped. We have an email from Charlie in Columbus. What are your thoughts on Motorola's new Droid Razr M compared to the new iPhone and the Galaxy S3?
I actually have been using a Droid Razr M for about a week now, and I'll have a review posted later on this morning, I think, this afternoon. But I found the phone to be really enjoyable. It definitely compares with a lot of the devices that are out there right now. I love the fact that it doesn't have the biggest screen possible. A lot of these guys, Samsung and even Motorola for a couple of the devices that are coming out soon, have got, 4.5 and 5 inch screens on these phones. And I think that's kind of a bit of excessive. The 4.3-inch screen on the Razr M feels really nice. The screen's pretty high quality, and the battery life so far has been really enjoyable. For $100 on Verizon, I definitely think that that's the best phone in that category.
This is going to get to be a pretty busy time of year, right? Lots of stuff gets rolled out.
This is a nonstop kind of year.
No breaks, no rest for the wicked, huh?
Absolutely.
Coming up, we're going to talk with David in Columbus. David, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing? I had a question. I was trying to get an e-reader for my father. He's a little elderly, I guess, so I was trying to get the most simple and effective one. I thought also he could take to the libraries and download e-books. I didn't know if, and also maybe get access to his email and all. I didn't know like whether Kindle or the Nook was better, or if you had any advice on those, which one's easiest to use and seems to be the best.
So are you looking specifically for something that'll do a little bit more than you know, read books, or are you looking
for just kind of I might set them up with Wi-Fi, too, if it all works out.
Okay. You know, I found that between Amazon and Barnes & Noble, the ecosystem behind Amazon definitely feels a lot more developed. There's a lot more, you know, in the way of exploration there. There's a lot more apps. There's a lot more, you know, services that Amazon has that are included for free with devices like the Kindle Fire HD. So I think that, you know, when it comes to someone's, you know, kind of first device and breaking them into that ecosystem, that Amazon's probably the best way to go.
And okay. I've never tried it, but you can change the typeface and or the type size and all that kind of stuff on all of them, can't you?
Oh, absolutely. You can increase the font size or decrease the font size. You can actually even change white on black versus black on white for the font. There's a lot of control that's there.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, David. Thank you. Any parting thoughts? Are you excited? Are you going to – well, you never have to run out and really buy anything, do you?
Oh, no. I still definitely run out and buy stuff. You know, I got teased a little bit last year by my wife because I participated for the first time in probably 5 years in the Black Friday sales for a couple of things. And mostly it's just gifts for other people. But it's, you know, it's definitely one of those things. I get to play with them before they come out, but I still have to pay for them when they come out. So,
yeah, the Black Friday.
It's definitely something that I look forward to doing every year, though.
Well, we will definitely be having a pre-Black Friday show, so I hope you'll join us then, if not sooner.
Absolutely.
Okay. Russell Holly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly, tech blogger at geek.com. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me, Anne, on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU, All Sides staff. Thanks so much. Associate producer Amy Jurovich, All Sides assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, All Sides production assistants Katie Higgins and Leticia Wiggins, and volunteer Rose Joe, and our video production by Rich and Amber Karsmitsky. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station. It's a service of WOSU Public Media.